On this week's program, we've news of exciting developments in the Philadelphia Orchestra's summer season at the Mann Music Center. Susan Lewis looks at the history of fine art photography. We discover how Orchestra 2001 had to travel to Bucharest to find the score and orchestra parts for the US debut of George Enescu's Chamber Symphony. And Jason Pfeiffer visits the Media Theater as they stage Sigmund Romberg's 1924 masterpiece, The Student Prince. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
The Philadelphia Orchestra has announced Rosin Milanov as artistic director of its summer seasons at the Mann Music Center. Milanov began his career at the orchestra as an associate conductor before being promoted to his current position as associate conductor in 2000. In addition to his work in Philadelphia, Milanov is music director of both the Haddonfield Symphony in New Jersey and the New Symphony Orchestra in his native city of Sofia, Bulgaria. And since 2003, he's been chief conductor of the Bulgarian National Radio Symphony Orchestra. I met with Rosin Milanov earlier this week to talk about his plans for this season at the Mann and his overall programming philosophy for the popular outdoor venue.
Mann Music Center has been an institution in this city for 75 years already, and people expect when they go to the concerts at the Mann to be presented with something which has a little bit of a lighter appeal, a little bit more of a summer feel, if you wish, even. We are aware when we program that, and the way we try to connect the repertoire with the feel of the Mann Center is that in addition to what you hear at the concerts, there will be some series of special events that will happen either before or after the performance, which will give a little bit of a taste of what we normally do here, our normal concert season. So if someone wishes to be a little more involved, there will be certain opportunities that they could explore coming there and making their entire experience a little more richer.
This has all come as sort of sudden news to us, but obviously you've been working on this for quite a while. Can you tell me how it was first proposed to you that you would take up the artistic director position for the orchestra at the Mann, and then take me through your thinking on how you decided that this was something that you wanted to do? Yes. Because it's not as if you're not busy. Yeah. You've got three other orchestras on the go.
Yes, I see this as sort of a natural development of my relationship with the Philadelphia Orchestra. I have been a part of the orchestra staff conductors for the last 5.5 years. And during that time, we had various levels of collaborations, including pretty much everything that the orchestra does, starting from family and student concerts and going all the way up to subscriptions concerts. And I have been present in the Mann Center for the last 4 years in one way or another, doing either more popular or more serious concerts. For instance, last year I had the honor of closing the Mann season with Beethoven 9. So this was something that we obviously have tried in a various level. The decision to go into creating a position of artistic director of the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Center was something which came up organically as a result of what we have been trying to experiment with in the last few years, that both the orchestra and the administration felt that it would benefit from having someone to oversee the artistic programming product, someone that will have a more consistent presence on stage, and someone that will be able to connect with the audiences in a more immediate way, because we didn't have a face to our summer season for quite a few years, and we feel that having an artistic director could connect better to the audience, could bring a lot more energy to what we are trying to accomplish there.
And in your first season, what are the events that when they came to be, or when you managed to put them together, I'm talking about people like Denise Graves appearing there, that you went, aha, these are going to be some of the highlights?
If you look at the Mann season for this summer, you'll notice a few things. First of all, the change in the direction of the repertoire, which we already discussed. And second of all, you're going to notice a plethora of world-class soloists. And we are talking people like Itzhak Perlman, Viorel Mam, who actually literally is a household name in classical music. We have Hilary Hahn, we have Peter Serkin, we have our concertmaster David Kim, we have Alon Goldstein, a great and very talented young Israeli pianist. We have Christina Ortiz. We have people of that caliber, Denise Graves, as you mentioned. And I think it's very important that in the summer we are able to not only present these great names, but to give an opportunity for people like the soloists that I mentioned to come back to Philadelphia and be among friends, because we have a very long-standing relationship with all these names. And I'm so happy that this year we are able to reestablish the artistic prominence of the people that we are going to be collaborating with at the Mann Music Center.
One final question, something that as audience members we're often very aware of when there are outdoor concerts in Philadelphia, specifically at the Mann, but also the community concerts that you've done, often very hot, muggy days. What are the challenges, do you think, for the musicians and for the conductor indeed to produce at the height of their game in these kind of conditions?
The good news is that the Mann Center has been going through a very extensive modernization and project for really redevelopment of the whole venue over there. And what I'm told is that this year about 60% of those renovations are going to be completed, which translates into a place which will be a lot more friendly in terms of certain facilities for the patrons. It will enhance the entire experience of going to the Mann Center. In terms of the musicians on the other side, we have an air-conditioned stage. I don't know how many people are aware of it, but there is actually air-conditioned on stage, which is it does not work perfect because certain areas of the stage are colder than the others. So we have a combination of both fans and air-conditioned. So we could definitely deal with it, and so one could imagine that on stage it's not comfortable, but actually it's not so bad.
The newly appointed artistic director of the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Music Center, Rossin Milanoff. The orchestra season at the Mann kicks off on June 20th with Maestro Milanoff conducting Beethoven's Violin Concerto with Itzhak Perlman. The program also features Dvorak's Carnival Overture and Rachmaninoff's Symphony Dances.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Photography is now an accepted part of the art scene, even at traditional bastions of classical art forms. But did photographs always garner art world respect? Creatively Speaking, Susan Lewis explores the history of fine art photography and asks what makes these photographs art, while most of our snaps are at best just pretty pictures.
At some point in our lives, most of us have had a camera of sorts, an easy Instamatic, a fancy SLR, or something in between. We pull them out for baby pictures, birthday parties, holidays, reunions, and automatically toss them into our vacation bags for memories of the beach or historic sites, or perhaps for those ubiquitous sightings of the tops of clouds out of airplane windows. Today, we could take digital shots and even play around with the images on our computers before we print them out ourselves. But still, how many of us consider ourselves real photographers? The word photograph comes from the Greek words for light and writing. But what makes a photograph art? Does it depend on the intent of the photographer? What it's used for? Or just how cool the final image looks? When do our pictures match the quality you'd see in a magazine or newspaper, let alone the artistry you'd find on a museum gallery wall? Peter Barberry, curatorial fellow in photography at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, says there's no clean answer as to what's art and what's not.
I have never known anybody that could define art in a way that nailed it down perfectly and that satisfied me. The rules for what art is change over time and through history.
Louise Krasnowitz, senior research scientist at the University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, agrees.
Why do we call one art and one not art? That says a lot more about us than it does about the images themselves.
When photographs were invented, they were put to practical and aesthetic uses. French theater owner Louis Daguerre and English scientist Henry Fox Talbot each produced a successful photograph around 1839, and photographs were soon used for everything from botanical studies and cityscapes to portraits. But the art world's reaction to photography was mixed, says Barberry.
The art world first was amazed and delighted, and then quickly very worried. And you get certain factions of the art world throughout the 19th century resisting photography and attacking it. Printmakers realized that a lot of the tasks that prints were used for were going to be usurped by photography. It was commonly a cliche in the 19th century that photography would replace painting.
Instead, photography grew into its own form of expression as a way to document reality, express ideas, and perhaps most significantly, produce images on a scale never before seen.
And it really has changed the nature of visual experience. I mean, there were thousands and thousands of prints in the world in the 19th century and thousands of paintings, but within a matter of 10 years, there were millions of photographs.
Millions of photographs. And photographers whose numbers increased exponentially with George Eastman's 1888 invention of a box camera for popular use. Then again in the early 1920s with the introduction of the handheld camera. And photography went in as many directions as those who tried it. In the late 19th century art world, there were the pictorialists who sought to distinguish themselves as artists by adding unique features, printing on fine paper, signing their photographs with monograms, or framing them beautifully. They chose subjects like those of the symbolist and impressionist painters of the 19th century, says Barberry.
Beautiful women in beautiful settings, children, lots of very moody landscapes at certain times of day, sunset or sunrise, things like that.
Beyond the art world, ordinary people began using handheld cameras to document family life as we do today. And working somewhere in between documentation and pure aesthetic was the illustrated magazine world, populated by the likes of Life, Time, and National Geographic. Louise Krasnowitz walked us through, in focus, National Geographic's Greatest Portraits, a traveling exhibition at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. She says that although the magazine was documenting stories of people and cultures around the world, its photographs had particular interpretive styles. Traveling into millions of households, they influenced both popular and art photography.
Really, what it did was shift the criteria for what a quality or good photograph is to this sort of style where you have these bright, glaring colors sometimes, really, these very sort of stylized setups of people at interesting angles. If you were to go into a gallery in the 80s and 90s, you saw a lot of pictures that borrowed from this aesthetic.
Current consumer-friendly digital technology may blur the line even further between personal and art photography. Although, as the Philadelphia Museum of Art's Peter Barberry points out, this digital method is a whole different process, about which there is some debate in the art world.
For a lot of art historians like myself, what is really special about photography is that it's a silver-based medium. It's an image made by light thrown onto certain objects in the world. Whereas digital photography is made through the technology of computers and the digital camera, and it relies on computer programs. It's much closer, in my opinion, to earlier picture-making forms like printmaking or drawing or painting. But most photographers I talk to are not that worried about this distinction. They think the digital processes simply allow them to do what they care about doing in photography even better.
It's clear that photography, using film, digital processing, or some newly evolving technology, has taken its place alongside other media in the art world, and we can see shows of different types in all sorts of venues. Until April 29th, the Fleischer Art Memorial shows experimentations in photography by artists who use digital cameras with Polaroid processing. A collection of works by famed photographer Ansel Adams is at the Michener Museum through May 14th. This spring, work of local self-taught photographer Zoe Strauss, who currently has work at the Whitney's Biennial 2006 in New York, goes up at the Institute of Contemporary Art. And come summer, the Philadelphia Museum of Art will host Dreaming in Black and White, a range of photography from the collection of Julian Levy, the 20th century art dealer who promoted the big names of the art world, but also loved and collected popular photography of every sort. The museum is currently showing Clarence John Laughlin's Secret Life of Buildings, while In Focus, National Geographic's Greatest Portraits, is at the University of Pennsylvania Museum. So about this question of photography as art, maybe it's for each of us to decide. In the end, art may be whatever image moves you or changes the way you feel about your world, whether it's the work of a stranger in a museum gallery or a picture that evokes a cherished memory hanging in your own home.
Creatively speaking, Susan Lewis. Orchestra 2001's decision to perform George Enescu's Symphony for Chamber Orchestra began an ultimately fruitless search for the score in the United States. They then turned for help to renowned cellist George Anastasiu, a Romanian native who went to Bucharest to find the score. Earlier this week, George Anastasio and Orchestra 2001 music director James Friedman came into our studios to tell of their hunt for Enescu's late great symphony.
One of Orchestra 2001's board members found a recording of the piece, and he sent it to me. And I thought, gee, this is really an extraordinary and very beautiful piece. Let's make this the centerpiece of a program. Then, when we started trying to find a score and parts, we couldn't find them. We contacted every publisher I knew of, and I finally thought of the Atanasius, who come from Romania, and I thought, damn, I bet they can find a way to find the stuff. And I called George, and I think I passed the story on to George now at this point.
It was probably December when
something
Jim
like
called
that,
and
yes.
says, George, I'm in a situation that I'm scheduling a piece and I cannot find the music. I suggested the Fleischmann library and they didn't have it. And then there is an Enescu center in Pella that he contacted. And it just happened that I had a trip to Europe and I went to Germany in January. Then after Germany, I went for the weekend to Romania and I tried to get to the Union of Composers there. And the music was on loan, was not there. And finally, I got it to the Bucharest Academy of Music, where they have the music. And I went and I copied it with their accord. And I came with the music and I gave it to Jim at the beginning of February.
And there must have been a real sense of holding the Holy Grail at this point when he actually came back and presented
exactly.
this.
Exactly. Well, you know, I was thinking, what are we going to do? We have this piece scheduled. I have the musicians hired for it, the specific musicians, because it's scored for a rather unusual ensemble, actually. It's sort of one of each ensemble plus piano, but plus English horn, which is the one thing that makes it quite different from most other pieces that are sort of in that genre. I think it's 12 or 13 musicians. Anyway, they were all hired, and the rehearsal schedule was out, and I didn't know what I was going to do, so I'm very, very grateful to George for finding it.
This work was written in the last year of Enescu's life, George. I mean, famously, we have other composers who wrote great works, Mahler's Ninth, Magic Flute Mozart, many other composers who wrote great works in the end of their lives. It begs the question, though, if it's taken 50 years for this piece to be performed in the United States, is it any good?
Well, I think it's a beautiful music, like all Enescu's music. Unfortunately, what happened with his work has been too much characterized by the rhapsodies. The rhapsodies are just the beginning. It's just the music that Enescu wrote in his youth, along with the Romanian poem when he was 17, 18, 19, 20, up to 21, and then becoming so popular has become, in a way, the curse of his music. He wrote beautiful, beautiful other music. He wrote the opera, which Stravinsky called it the most beautiful opera of the 20th century, Oedipus Rex. He wrote three symphonies. He wrote a symphonic poem with choir. He wrote wonderful chamber music. He wrote orchestral suites. And his chamber symphony is his last work that he has written in Paris. He completed just a few months before his death.
Jim, George mentions the rhapsodies, and obviously he's very famous for the influence of Romanian folk music. Is there any hint of that in this piece?
I think there is a little hint of it, but it's primarily not a Romanian piece. It's not filled with Romanian folk melodies, for instance. Actually, the piece reminds me more than anything else of early Schoenberg, the Chamber Symphony of Schoenberg, especially, I think, is sort of the model for this piece. And it's an absolutely beautiful piece. I agree with George that this is an enormously neglected composer who is now, half a century later, coming into his own, we hope. And I agree also that the first Romanian Rhapsody especially, which is a terrific pops piece, by the way, but it is a pops piece. I think even George, didn't he sort of disavow that piece later on?
He tried many, many times to
brush it
detach
aside.
Himself right. from that music, because everywhere he went, to conduct, even in Philadelphia, I believe in 1935, when he performed as a conductor, as soloist, many people ask him about Romanian rhapsodies. Would you like to play? He says, no. Next question, please.
Cellist George Anastasio and Orchestra 2001 music director James Freeman. One of the first American performances of George Enescu's Chamber Symphony Opus 33 can be heard in the latest Orchestra 2001 concert series this evening at 8 at the Trinity Center at 22nd and Spruce Streets in Philadelphia, and again tomorrow evening at 7:30 at Lang Concert Hall at Swarthmore College. Here's a brief excerpt from the work, a performance by the Chamber Orchestra of Lausanne, conducted by Lawrence Foster. When the Media Theatre in suburban Philadelphia was built in 1927, it initially served as a venue for vaudeville performances and silent movies. Neither of these entertainment forms is very common today. The latest show to take the stage at the Media, Sigmund Romberg's The Student Prince, is also relatively unknown to today's audiences. Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer has more on Romberg's 81-year-old masterpiece and this latest revival.
When looking back on the history of The Student Prince, there's one performer who's hard to avoid, especially in the Philadelphia region.
Who else can you think of when you think of The Student Prince and the male singer, Mario Lanza?
That's Michael White, director of the Media Theater's Student Prince, talking about the rich heritage of the operetta that was made into a film in 1954, and featured the singing of Mario Lanza. But long before the South Philadelphia tenor boosted the popularity of the operetta's music, The Student Prince already had an enormous fan base. It made its premiere in 1924, and today the Sigmund Romberg work still has the distinction of being the longest-running Broadway operetta, with over 600 performances in the initial run. At the Media Theater, one of just a few companies in the region solely dedicated to music theater, this is the second time in 7 years the show has been staged.
Why The Student Prince for this season?
Selfishness. It's a score that I dearly love.
Jesse Klein has been artistic director of the Media Theater since its inception in 1994. He identifies a nostalgic hunger for the piece.
This was the kind of show that families in Brooklyn and Queens and the Bronx would get on the subway on a Saturday afternoon and come down and see The Student Prince. It has a whole history unto itself. And there are people who are so closely aligned to this music. The last time we did it, we had people coming from all over. We had some people coming from Indiana to see it because you obviously still hear recordings, but you can't see it any longer. Nobody does it.
The Student Prince is a musical adaptation of the 1901 German play Alt Heidelberg by Wilhelm Meyer Forrester. The narrative follows the Prince of Carlsberg, Karl Franz, as he goes off to attend Heidelberg University. Taken in by the excitement, camaraderie, and charm of the German university town, the sheltered young prince quickly falls in love with the innkeeper's niece, Kathy. Soprano Jenny Millsap plays Kathy. She views the show as a love poem to Heidelberg.
There's kind of a tender spot in my heart for it because my mom was born in Heidelberg. The descriptions of Heidelberg, while really romantic, are really true. I spent some time there a few years ago, and it's a beautiful, magical city with the castle on the hill overlooking the city and the old winding streets and the beer gardens, and it's really an enchanting place.
The allure of the student prince seems to be linked to the fond memories that many people hold for their university days and their old college town. But the memorable music of the operetta is undoubtedly part of the appeal as well. Here, the Media Theater cast sings Serenade from the Student Prince. As an operetta, which literally means little opera, the subject matter of The Student Prince is lighter and less serious than the more traditional tragic operas. And as is the case in many operettas, The Student Prince also includes some spoken dialogue. Director Michael White explains that The Student Prince doesn't quite qualify as conventional musical theater either.
The main distinction between the operetta and the modern musical is when the operettas were written, which was earlier in the century, they were sung by opera singers, trained voices, and the plot, the book, was not as important as the music. Acting was secondary at the time. It was really a concert and a book was put to it. The original intent for the operetta was to hear the gorgeous music and to weave a story around it.
White points out that musical theater, on the other hand, tends to spotlight the narrative more and traditionally utilizes actors who can sing well. A classically trained singer, Jenny Millsap has experience in both the operatic and the musical theater worlds. While acknowledging that there's a lot of overlap between the two forms, Millsap also notices the need to approach musical theater differently than operas and operettas.
Music theater is really about the book. It's about the story. And a heavy operatic vocal production can interfere with that kind of presentation of a story.
Operettas are still frequently performed in concert halls and theaters all around the world. Stagings of these so-called little operas aren't rare, per se. Yet most of the productions staged by the Media Theater fall under the label of musical theater. Operettas aren't standard fare for this company. However, artistic director Jesse Klein says he hopes to develop a tradition of staging an operetta roughly every 2 years. He jokes that next up might be the Desert Song, another Sigmund Romberg operetta with popular recordings made by Philadelphia's Mario Lanza.
Creatively Speaking's Jason Pfeiffer. The Student Prince is at the Media Theater through April 2nd. And that's it for this week. Our program written and produced by Teresa Madden and myself, with thanks also this week to Roger Ricker, Catherine Blodgett, Frank Luzzi, Debbie Fleischman, Pam Costi and Paula Butler. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.